Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. It's open forum. That's a good thing. That's a little bonus on a Friday, an open forum. You can call and ask any question you want, 888-318-7884. You want me to tell you, it's even better than that. Jimmy Akin's here. When Jimmy's here, you can ask whatever you want. Like, we really literally mean whatever you want. 888-318-7884. Don't ask about sports ball.
No sports ball. Other than that, most subjects.
Okay, fair enough. Lots of folks on the line, so I think as a matter of fact, every line full at the moment. So I think I'll go right back to the phones, if that's all right with you, Jimmy.
Sure.
All right, let's go to Fredericksburg, Virginia. John is in Fredericksburg, Virginia, watching on YouTube. John, thank you very much for the call. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hi, guys. Thanks for taking my call. Jimmy, I've recently taken an interest in medieval saints, particularly royal kings, you know, mm-hmm. St. Stephen of Hungary, St. Henry, you know, the Holy Roman Empire. My question is about Charlemagne, because I've heard mixed reviews. If Charlemagne is a saint or considered a saint in the church, and if he's someone we should revere or not.
Well, what I can tell you is I haven't done a detailed research into Charlemagne's case, but what I can tell you is that my understanding is that Charlemagne was canonized by Pope Pascal III. But there's a problem, because Pascal III was not really a pope. He was what's known as an antipope. That is, a false claimant to the papal office. And after his tenure, one of the Lateran councils canceled all of his decrees because he had exercised authority illegitimately. And so that means that Charlemagne is not today regarded as a saint in the Catholic Church. I have heard it claimed that he is recognized as a beatus, that is, someone who is blessed, someone who has been beatified. But I have not been able to locate when or where that was done or how. So I don't know that that's the case. What I can say is he's not a saint, because the pope who tried to canonize him wasn't actually a pope. But whether or not he's a beatus, I would need to run it to ground to say, okay, so where and when, what were the circumstances of his beatification in order to establish if he was a beatus?
Okay, John?
Okay. Okay, so approach that with caution then.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Okay. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Well, thank you, John. I know you waited through the break and everything, so thank you for waiting so we could get that question on. And call anytime if you got a question. I'm going to go to Austin, Texas now. Troy is in Austin, Texas, listening on the Catholic Answers Live app. Troy, glad you're here. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hi. I got a question for you. It's really not so much about anything in particular, but it is about what you said in the past and a couple things that I've heard Trent Horn say in the past as well. I guess the best way that I could put it is I've heard you guys approximately say that God couldn't make a square circle or something like that. I'm really just giving this as an invitation for you to speak more about that. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. Well, I like the way, Troy, that you may have put it to the call screener, because he wrote, you've said that God can't make 1 + 1 = 3. Could you elaborate on more on that? And sure, in fact, there are discussions of what 1 + 1 = that are of considerable length. Back in the early 20th century, a couple of mathematical philosophers named Bertrand Russell and Alfred North Whitehead were doing a work called Principia Mathematica on the foundations of mathematics. And they took it's something like 300 pages to rigorously prove that 1 + 1 = 2. I mean, that's really, you get like 300 pages into the book and you get up to the 1 + 1 = 2 point. So they were being really rigorous. And what they were doing was trying to use logic extremely rigorously to establish the foundations of mathematics. And they did that. Unfortunately, their overall project was to ground all of mathematics in logic in a rigorous way. And they thought they might have succeeded. And then in around, I think it was 1930, the German mathematician Kurt Gödel came and smashed their project to the ground by proving that any sufficiently powerful mathematical system will incorporate statements that cannot be proved from fundamental axioms. It's a proof known as Gödel's incompleteness theorem. And it demonstrated that not just Russell and Whitehead couldn't ground mathematics rigorously in logic, but nobody could. There will always be additional mathematical truths that you cannot prove from a limited finite set of axioms. But what Russell and Whitehead did succeed in doing was rigorously showing that 1 + 1 = 2. That was one of the things they showed. And so that means 1 + 1 can't = 3 by definition. And that's the key to what you've heard me say before and what you've heard Trent say before, which is that in his omnipotence, God can bring about any logically possible state of affairs. And so he has loads of power. Anything that's logically possible, God can make happen. And so what's logically possible mean? Well, it's a term of art that gets used in philosophy. And basically, something's logically possible as long as the terms involved do not contradict each other. So Cy Kellett is wearing a blue blouse. There are no contradictions involved in those terms, so it's logically possible that Cy Kellett could be wearing a blue blouse. Or Cy Kellett has a koala clipped to his microphone. Well, there's no contradiction in those terms, so God could bring it about that Cy Kellett has a koala clipped to his microphone. But Cy Kellett is an unmarried, is a married bachelor. That God could not bring about because married and bachelor contradict each other. So you can say Cy Kellett is a married bachelor, but that doesn't have any actual meaning because the terms involved, bachelor and married, contradict each other. Similarly, you could say the man Cy Kellett is a prime number. Well, that's also just nonsense because the concept of man and the concept of prime number contradict each other. You can't have a man that's a prime number or a prime number that's a man. So that would, again, be something you can say. But if you try to cash it out in what would this mean, it turns out to just be gibberish. And so the idea is God can make anything that's possible, but he can't make things that are gibberish, that don't have any sensible meaning, because the terms involved contradict each other. So if you go back to our original example, if you think about the meaning of the term one and the meaning of the term plus and the meaning of the term one and the meaning of the term equal, if you understand those terms correctly, they don't equal three, they equal two, as Russell and Whitehead showed rigorously. So that's a general sketch of what logical possibility is and how it applies to different examples.
Troy, that's what you were looking for?
Yeah, pretty much. I'm still having a few issues with, I don't know, God, it seems such a powerful being to me. He would only be an immensely powerful being, not a perfectly powerful being, if he couldn't make a square circle or... I remember I was in high school and I would be questioned, can God make a boulder that he can't move? And it wasn't very tough question.
Yeah. So what the solution is, you need to understand or try to understand the concepts of things that you want God to make. In the case of a square circle, the way that is, now we're not talking about a cylinder where you look at it from above and it's a circle and you look at it from the side and it's a square. You know, that's not what we mean when we say square circle. When the question is posed, can God make a square circle? We're talking about a shape, a two-dimensional shape that has a circular perimeter only and that has a square perimeter only at the same time, in the same place, in the same relation. And if you try to think about that, you'll realize that there's just a contradiction there. That has no sensible meaning. And so God is perfectly powerful in the sense he can create anything that has meaning, but square circle does not have meaning. And in the same way, if you think about rock too heavy for God to lift, well, God has infinite lifting power, and there's different kinds of infinities, but, you know, just scale it up to the top. In order for a rock to be too heavy for God to lift, it would have to weigh more than infinity. And more than infinity has no meaning. It involves a logical contradiction, because the infinite is unlimited by definition. So the rock would have to have more than unlimited weight, in the strongest sense of unlimited. And that, again, that just has no meaning. So God is perfectly powerful in the sense that he can make absolutely everything that has meaning, but he can't make gibberish. If I said, can God make Mamu dog face the banana patch? Well, that's Mamu dog face the banana patch, as Steve Martin informs us, has no meaning. It doesn't mean anything. So I haven't said something that God could make, because Mamu dog face the banana patch doesn't have any meaning at all. It incorporates elements like dog face and banana patch that do have meaning, but when you put it all together, it doesn't mean anything. And in the same way, if you say square circle or rock too heavy for God to lift or four-sided triangle, when the individual terms have meaning, but when you put them all together, they don't have meaning, because they contradict each other. And so God is perfectly powerful in the sense he can make anything that has meaning, but he can't make meaningless things, things that make no logical sense.
Troy, I do hope that was helpful. Thank you for the call and the question. We have to take a quick break. Right back with more Open Forum with Jimmy Akin right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
Miss a show? Make sure to catch up by downloading the podcast, available online at Catholic.com.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
We should pray, because prayer is conversation with God, and conversation is the only way to build a relationship. We need that relationship with God. We should pray and talk with God about what's on our hearts, what's on our minds, what's active in our lives, the joys we have. We should share all of these with God. Prayer is conversation, and conversation is the only way to build a relationship with God. It's the most important relationship. All of our other relationships depend on this one.
Catholic Answers Live, Open Forum. Jimmy Akin is our guest. Your call is welcome, 888-318-7884. And hey, we're having a big, giant digital mega sale over at shop.catholic.com. Check it out. Hundreds of ebooks, MP3s, e-magazines, digital videos, and online courses are on sale. The savings are up to 50%, which is pretty awesome. And if you don't get over there today, no problem. We're keeping it through midnight Hawaii time on Sunday. That's midnight Honolulu time on Sunday. The sale will end. Digital mega sale. Don't miss out on dynamite savings at shop.catholic.com. Jimmy Akin, our guest, as I said, and lots of folks on the line. And I don't think we have spoken to a Canadian yet today. So we go to Roman in Alberta, Canada, watching on YouTube. Roman, thank you for the call. Go ahead with the question.
Hey, Jimmy, I just wanted to compliment you on your debate with Dr. Michael Heiser on the New Testament reliability about a year ago. I just seen that recently, and I thought you killed it.
Oh, thank you. That was actually Dr. Bart Ehrman. But yes, thank you.
Oh, what did I say?
Oh, yeah, you said Michael Heiser. Michael I think Heiser. You're about to ask a question Michael
Heiser.
Question. Yeah,
sorry, all right. That's my question. Yes.
Okay,
that's
yeah.
What are you aware of Dr. Michael Heiser and on his work on the Divine Council, and what are your thoughts on it? Me personally, after reading his book, such as The Unseen Realm, it has brought me back to Catholicism as I was reading it. It sounded so much like Intercession of Saints.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you. Yes, I know of Michael Heiser. I even knew Michael Heiser. I had contact with him. I even interviewed him once, although the interview didn't end up getting published, but it may at some point if I ever find the files. But he was, for people who may not know, he was an evangelical scholar, and he was a specialist in ancient Near Eastern languages and texts. And so one of the things that he did was he would look at biblical texts in light of other ancient Near Eastern literature that could shed light on them. And one of the things that he wrote about was what's known as the Divine Council. The Divine Council is an image that is used in a variety of ancient Near Eastern texts that talk about God, the high God, El, and an association of other heavenly beings who serve as his council. And the way this is pictured, for example, in Canaanite literature, is you've got the high god El, and then you have this pantheon of lesser gods that serve as El's council, and they discuss matters. They under El's, who's the supreme king, under El's rule, they make decisions and they cause things in the world and to happen, and so it functions like a king's court. Because a king in the ancient Near East, I mean, he's not the only guy in the government. He's the top guy. He's the decision maker or the decider, as George Bush would say. But he's not the only guy. He's got a council of advisors who give him advice and make proposals and execute his orders. And so the ancient Near Eastern people frequently would consider God like that. God is a great king, so he must have a council up there that's assisting him. Now, the Canaanites would regard these other deities, these other council members, I should say, as deities that you could worship. So, for example, you could worship Baal, the storm god, and you could worship Yam, the sea god, and you could worship Mot, the god of death, or Asherah, who was a goddess, or things like that. And the Hebrews said, no, you can't. At least we can't. We have a covenant with El, with Yahweh the Creator. We're not supposed to worship anybody else. But they didn't have a problem with the idea of God having a council. In fact, we even see it referred to in a number of passages in the Old Testament. One of the easiest ones to see is in the book of Job. In the book of Job, we begin with the scene in heaven, and it says, one day up in heaven, the sons of God came in before God. So this is El. That's the El is just the Hebrew word for God. So you've got the sons of El, or the sons of God, coming before El, or God. And also, Satan, or Satan, to pronounce it the English way, he comes in too. Satan in Hebrew means accuser or adversary or opponent. And what we're seeing here is a court scene, like a king's court. In a king's court, Sykhelet. Who are the most important people in a king's court? Is it the lowly messengers who run errands, or is it the princes, the sons of the king?
That would be those princes.
Yeah, so we've got these high-ranking celestial beings that are referred to as sons of El, and then also this opponent comes in, and he's basically the court prosecutor, or you could think of him as like a kind of a spy. He's and God says to Satan, "What have you been doing?" And he says, "Well, I've been walking up and down on the earth." You know, which is what you do if you're kind of a watchman or spy for the king. And God says, "Have you considered my servant Job? Because he's a super cool dude." And Satan falsely accuses Job and says, "Oh, he's only a fair weather friend. I haven't been able to hurt him because you put a hedge around him, but, you know, let him get hit with affliction and he'll curse you to your face." And God says, "Well, we'll see about this, won't we?" And he lets Satan have the ability to inflict harm on Job, but not to kill him. And indeed, Job does not curse God. He gets a little confused later in the book, but he does not curse God. He remains faithful. And so God proves Satan wrong. Well, this is basically a courtroom scene where you've got the king, you've got the king's court consisting of the princes, and you've got a court official whose job is basically to function like a prosecutor. And so we see the divine counsel not only in non-Israelite ancient Near Eastern literature, we also see it in the Bible. And this is not unique to Michael Heiser. This is actually this is the commonly received view among people who've studied this question. And I've studied it myself. In fact, I was writing about the divine counsel before I knew Michael Heiser, before I'd read his stuff. If you go to my personal website, jimmyakin.com, and type in divine counsel, you'll find some stuff I wrote about it before I even knew Mike. So I think that his work on the divine counsel is valuable. I don't agree with everything, you know, Mike thought. And by the way, he passed away earlier this year, just a few months ago. So I would encourage people to pray for the repose of his soul and for the wife and children he left behind, because he died at a not that old age. And he left a family behind him. So I would very much encourage people to pray for them and for Mike. I don't agree with everything he said, but he did a lot of valuable work.
All right, Roman.
Yeah, that was perfect. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. I appreciate the call. On we go to Cleveland now. Al is in Cleveland, Ohio, listening on AM 1260 The Rock. Al, glad you're here. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hello, Jimmy and everybody. I just want to let everybody know my mom is watching the TV in another room, so she's waiting to hear my question here.
Hi, Mom.
What's your question?
So my question is, in the Bible, there's the two witnesses of Revelation, mm-hmm. and that's chapter 11, verse 3, mm-hmm. and those are commonly understood to be Enoch and Elijah, and then in the fourth book of Kings, Elijah is taken up in a fiery chariot, and so it's mm-hmm. commonly understood, my understanding and tradition is that Elijah and Enoch are the only two mortals that have never experienced death. They're still alive. I mean, that's just what I've read or heard. So is that true? And if it is true, I mean, Elijah's taken up in a chariot, so then what? Is Elijah and Enoch, are they living on the moon or something? Are they in outer space?
Where are they?
How does this work? Are they? Yeah, where are they?
All right, Jimmy. Oh, I'm sorry.
Okay.
Go ahead.
So, So I got enough to answer the question.
Yeah.
So what the Bible says in regard to Enoch is that he walked with the Lord for 365 years, and then he was no more, for the Lord took him. But it doesn't say where, but presumably he's not on earth anymore. When it comes to Elijah, it says that God took him up into heaven, and it uses the word for heaven in Hebrew, which is Shemaim. And so he took him to Shemaim in a whirlwind. You'll sometimes hear it said that he took him up in a fiery chariot. Not right. God came down in a fiery chariot when this happened, but Elijah himself goes up in a whirlwind. So we're told his location is Shemaim. Now, that wouldn't prevent him from going, and by Shemaim, it would be understood he went to the place where God is, not the heaven of the atmosphere, not the heaven of outer space, but the heaven of God and the angels. And so that's the view that's common among scholars, is that, well, okay, it's saying that these two individuals basically were taken to God's heaven, not the moon or some other location. That wouldn't stop them from going elsewhere. In fact, as I covered in a pair of episodes on Mysterious World about the Seventh-day Prophetess, Ellen Gould White, she actually says she got to meet Enoch on another planet. So at least in her vision, she saw him on another planet, which actually, based on the evidence, would have been one of the ones in our outer solar system. Unfortunately, because the evidence points to it being one of the planets in the outer solar system, her description of it tends to count as evidence against the validity of her revelations, because she described a whole civilization of human beings on it that ain't there. So it's a fun story, but I don't think it was an accurate vision. Presumably, these individuals, Enoch and Elijah, would still be with God in the spiritual heaven, and they would have their bodies there, just like Jesus and Mary have their bodies there. Exactly how that works, we don't know, but that would seem to be the case. What about the two witnesses? Well, here, there's a little bit more to say, and I'll say it on the other side of the break.
If you could hang on, we would appreciate it, and we will get you the rest of that answer on the other side of the break. Jimmy Akin is our guest. It's Open Forum. More Catholic Answers Live right after this.
Why We're Catholic is the one book you can hand to anyone to invite them into or back to the Catholic faith. With more than 400,000 copies sold, Trent Horn's book has had a number one ranking on Amazon.com for 5 years running. Now available in softcover, bulk cases, ebook, and on Audible. Find out what the excitement is all about. Order your copies of Why We're Catholic at shop.catholic.com or visit whywearecatholic.com.
Is relativism dead? It sure seems dead. Each day, new moral demands are made and they are presented to us as absolutes. Everything from transgender ideology to physician-assisted suicide is presented as a moral good that all right-thinking people must accept. But Catholic Answers' own Carla Broussard says look deeper, and you will see today's moralism is just relativism dressed up in new clothes. Carla's eye-opening book, The New Relativism, shines a light on how the sacred moral teachings of this age cover up a deep denial of moral truth. Order your copy of The New Relativism today at shop.catholic.com and be prepared to defend the truth against aggressive relativism. The New Relativism at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Our Lord needs articulate defenders of the truth to spread the joy of the Catholic faith. Catholic Answers Monthly Giving Club, Society 315, helps you fulfill the call in 1 Peter 3:15 to always be prepared to make a defense for the hope that is in you. For as little as $10 a month, you'll help Catholics grow in faith, bring lapsed Catholics home, and lead non-Catholics to the truth. Go to CASociety315.com and join today.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live, Open Forum, Jimmy Akin, our guest. I was talking with Tim Staples just before the show, and they, Parousia Media there in Australia, and along with Catholic Answers, are sponsoring this trip that Tim is leading to the Holy Land on November 10th. And he told me they have seven spots left. They're only taking 55 people. They have seven spots left. If you'd like to go to the Holy Land with Tim Staples, you can do so in just about a month and a half. Just go to harvestjourneys.com and find the wonders, the Footsteps of Jesus tour with Tim Staples from Parousia Ministries, harvestjourneys.com. 888-318-7884 is our number here. Jimmy, you were in the midst of answering whatever happened to Enoch and Elijah.
Yeah, so Al asked if they might be the two witnesses that are described in Revelation chapter 11, and that is a common view. You will hear, you will hear the two witnesses described as Enoch and Elijah from various people, and you do have those two individuals in the Old Testament not recorded as having died, and then the two witnesses end up getting killed in Revelation 11. And so I guess that's what suggested to some people that they're Enoch and Elijah, and their death has just been kind of delayed, and then they finally experience death like everybody else. But I don't think that's who they are. I think that this text is working on more than one level. And on the first level, we need to figure out who they are. So the clues that we need to figure out who they are really found in verse 6 of the of chapter 11 of Revelation. So we've got these two witnesses, and I think it's right to connect them to Old Testament figures, but not Enoch and Elijah. The first thing we read in verse 6 is they have power to shut the sky, that no rain may fall during the days of their prophesying. Okay, can you, Sykelet, think of anybody in the Old Testament who had the power to shut the sky to keep rain from falling as a result of his prayers? Any one of the prophets, maybe?
Elijah?
Elijah, yeah. So I think this. I think one of the witnesses is Elijah.
Oh, gotcha.
But I don't think the other one is Enoch. So here's what we're also told. In the second half of verse 6, we read, and they have the power over the waters to turn them into blood and to afflict the earth with every plague as often as they desire. So, Sykelet, can you think of anyone in the Old Testament who turned water to blood and inflicted a land with multiple plagues?
That sounds so much like Moses.
Yeah, ding, 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 Moses. So I think that's who they are on this level of the text. They're not Enoch and Elijah. They're Elijah and Moses. And I think that's very clearly telegraphed to us by John, who gives us these clues that anybody who's read the Old Testament and is familiar with it would be able to pick up on. So, I mean, you don't have to be a deep Old Testament scholar. You just have to know the basic stories. And Enoch and Elijah and Moses are going to leap out at you. So do Moses and Elijah symbolize anything else that you're familiar with in Scripture? Together as a pair.
Oh, I am doing so well today. The law and the prophets.
Right. Moses is the law. Moses represents the law, and Elijah represents the prophets. Yeah. So I think that's what the deeper level of the text is referring to. The law and the prophets are God's witnesses to Christ. And so I think this is a highly symbolic text. I think on one level, the symbolism points to Moses and Elijah, and on a deeper level, it points to the law and the prophets being God's witness to Jesus as the Christ.
Al, I'm going to leave it there because I've got a full bank of a phone line here, so I want to get to everybody, but thanks for the question, and goodbye, Al's mom. Thanks for watching. Bill's in Ohio watching on YouTube. Bill, thank you very much for waiting. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy. Bill? All right. I'll come back to Bill. We'll get him on the line in a moment. Let's go to Kentucky, where Jim is listening on the Catholic Answers Live app. Jim, thank you for waiting. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hey, guys. How are you?
Very well.
So I've been... I've reverted back to the faith back in January this year, and so I've been listening to a lot of media. And I'm from a non-Catholic tradition, and I've been listening to Catholic media trying to get up to speed because I've been out for 30 years. And so I went back to my non-Catholic tradition website and heard a talk where a Catholic professor was invited into a symposium, and he spoke on a Reformation topic. And he got to the question of authority, and he mentioned a term called shadow magisterium, and he defined that, and he didn't really go into it, but he defined that as things like EWTN, Scott Hahn, and Bishop Barron, and he mentioned Bishop Barron, who is a bishop who largely communicates as a teaching outside of the Episcopal channel. He didn't seem to speak in favor of this quote-unquote what he called shadow magisterium. And so I was wondering, and I tried to reach out to this person to see what he meant by that, but I haven't had success reaching him. So I wonder what you guys would think. What would that Catholic theologian mean by shadow magisterium? Do you have any idea? Is that a term that's normally used? Is that something you, what would you think that he meant by that?
This is a term that is not an official term, and it doesn't have any rigorous definition. It's not, you're not going to typically find this term in the scholarly literature, for example, and certainly not in church documents. But I know what he's talking about. And the basic idea would be, okay, so the magisterium functions to give official church teachings. And when you tack on the word shadow in front of it, that means a couple of things. One of them is we're not talking about the real magisterium of the church. The real magisterium of the church is the bishops teaching in union with the Pope. And Bishop Barron, being a bishop, would be a member of the real magisterium. But what this theologian is doing is indicating that there's something else besides the real magisterium that is in some way functioning as if it were the magisterium, even though it's not. And that makes it shady, which is why he's using the term shadow magisterium, as opposed to something else more neutral, like alternative magisterium or second magisterium, or to use a term that was favored actually by many on the progressive end of the theological spectrum a few decades ago, the magisterium of theologians, as opposed to the magisterium of bishops. But by calling it a shadow magisterium, he's referring to it as if it's in some way shadowy or shady. And it could be functioning as a magisterium in one of two ways. Either the members of it are acting as if they were the magisterium and claiming to issue authoritative teachings themselves, or they could be perceived as representing the true teachings of the church by people who are listening to them. And it could be both of those. It could be both they're acting as if they're the magisterium and they're being perceived by some people as if they were the magisterium. So what would I make of all this? Well, I think that this is not the most helpful term, and I think you can apply it to multiple different people, multiple different groups. It's not just EWTN and Scott Hahn and Bishop Barron. I've heard it to apply to others as well, like a shadow magisterium of apologists. And you can apply it to other people as well. I think there's something you could call a shadow magisterium of exorcists. There are a variety of popular exorcists, some of whom have YouTube channels, and some people treat them as if they're the bishops and the Pope. You know, and their first question is, I wonder what an exorcist would think about this, you know, and that's giving an exorcist an undue amount of deference. In fact, I may be covering this in the future on Mysterious World. Exorcists, they are trained in what they do, and they get rid of demons. But if you think about it, they're basically bouncers. You know, if you got a bar and someone's making a problem in a bar, you get the bouncer to kick the person out. Well, that's what exorcists do. And of course, like a bouncer, they're trained in how do you kick a person out of a bar, and exorcists are trained in how do you kick a demon out of a person. But that doesn't make them experts on everything. And so a question like, I wonder what an exorcist would think about that, is the wrong question. The better question would be, I wonder what someone who studied this subject would think about it. But don't automatically defer to an exorcist in this regard, just like you wouldn't automatically defer to anybody else who hasn't studied it. And then there's the magisterium of theologians that I mentioned before, that people on the progressive end of the spectrum would cite as an alternative to the quote-unquote magisterium of bishops. You would hear this phrase magisterium of theologians all the time a number of years ago. And you would have theologians who were progressive, who were proposing their own ideas as if they were what Catholics should believe, in contradistinction to what the bishops were actually teaching. So I think there are multiple different groups that could be referred to as shadow magisteria, but I don't think that the term is particularly, I think it's an insult term, I think there is an element of truth in it. Sometimes people can represent their own views as if they're the views of the church. Very few people actually do what the magisterium does in the sense of, I'm giving you this teaching by my own authority, you know, actually functioning as if they were bishops. Very few people who aren't bishops do that. You know, Scott Hahn doesn't do that. EWTN doesn't do that. So they're not functioning as the magisterium in that sense. Instead, what they're doing is giving their opinion of what they think the magisterium says. And you can think they're right, you can think they're wrong, you can think they're right on some points, wrong on some points. That's a matter for debate. But they're not functioning as a magisterium just by saying, I think the church teaches this. They're doing their best instead to represent the magisterium to other people. And so I don't think it's fair to accuse them on that ground of being a shadow magisterium, because they're just trying to communicate what they think the magisterium does teach. And I'd say the same thing about someone on the progressive end of the spectrum. If they're trying to communicate what they think the church does teach, whether they're right or wrong about that, they're not pronouncing teachings in their own name by their own authority. And so I would say, you know, they may be mistaken, but they're not acting as if they're a magisterium. What about the other way in which people could be thought of as a kind of magisterium, meaning there are people who listen to them in preference to listening to the magisterium of the bishops and the Pope? Well, I would say that's a problem. I wouldn't doubt that there are such people who treat, you know, apologists as if it would prefer to hear what an apologist says in preference to what the bishops and the Pope have actually said, or who would want to hear what Scott Hahn or EWTN or Bishop Barron has to say in preference to the actual magisterium as a whole, or people who would want to hear what exorcists have to say or what Jimmy Akin has to say. But if there are such people, I mean, they might want to hear it just for their own information. But if they were listening to anybody that is not actually the magisterium and treating it as authoritative rather than just as a source of information to think about and consider, then that's a mistake. But it's also not the fault of the person. You know, if there's some rabid Jimmy Akin fan out there who will take my word on anything, no matter what the Pope has said, well, I haven't done anything to encourage that. And so it wouldn't be my fault. I would want to do the best I can to let people know, hey, I'm just a layman. All I can do is give you idea. I can tell you my understanding of things. I can give you arguments to consider. I can give you evidence to consider. But I don't have authority. So don't treat me as an authoritative source in the sense you treat the magisterium as one. And so I would say there can be problems with, you know, folks who are fans in the classic sense of fanatics, who might be attached to apologists or me or Scott Hahn or an exorcist or Bishop Barron or anybody else, and treats them as having more authority than they actually do. And that's a problem, but it may not be the fault of the people in question. They may not have done anything to encourage this. And so I would say in those cases, it's unfair to refer to these people as a shadow magisterium because they haven't done anything to encourage that impression. They haven't said, listen to me in preference to the Pope and the bishops teaching in union with him. So I would say it's a slur and an insult word to use this term as a general course. Now, if there is someone out there who has been encouraging people to listen to me in preference to the bishops and the Pope and treat me as having more authority than I actually do, well, then that is a problem, and you could potentially validly accuse that person of acting as a shadow magisterium. But I think the number of people who actually do that is very few and very far between.
I want to come back to you, Jim. That you found that helpful, or did you have a follow-up question?
Well, that's great. So listen to your local diocese first, and then ask them in light of what you may hear in the quote-unquote shadow magisterium. It sounds like what you're saying.
Well, not just your local diocese, because although your local bishop is part of the magisterium, he teaches officially for the magisterium, provided he's teaching in communion with the Pope. So I would say listen to the Pope and listen to the bishops in communion with the Pope. Treat what they say as authoritative when they teach it authoritatively. If they say other things that are not meant to be authoritative teaching, then you're not obliged by that. If the Pope says, oh, chocolate ice cream is the best, that's not a doctrinal teaching. That's just a papal opinion. So you need to be careful to differentiate those. And to help you differentiate those, I actually wrote a book called Teaching with Authority. So, Jim, since you're in the United States, if you'll hang on the line, why don't we see if we can send you a copy of my book, Teaching with Authority, that's basically a theological manual on this whole subject that may give you some additional clarity.
Hang on, Jim. We'd love to send it to you. You got to take a quick break. Right back with more Open Forum with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
There's only one, Catholic Answers Live.
The Catechism defines evangelization as the proclamation of Christ and his gospel by word and the testimony of life. But what does that look like in real life? It looks like St. Paul street evangelists out in the public square sharing the good news. We're a Catholic nonprofit that starts conversations by handing out free sacramentals. Then we employ our method of listen, befriend, proclaim, and invite. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization. Visit streetevangelization.com to learn more.
It's You Choose Week on Take Two with Jerry and Debbie starting Monday.
This is a week-long celebration of topics suggested by you, the Take Two family.
Your submissions are always welcome at taketwoshow.com, and we will be spotlighting some of the great ideas you bring to the table on Take Two with Jerry and Debbie all next week, noon and midnight Eastern on EWTN Radio.
And it's your topics, so as a member of the Take Two family, you are the conversation.
You Choose Week on Take Two with Jerry and Debbie on EWTN Radio.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. It's Open Forum. Jimmy Akin is our guest. Mary Ann in British Columbia, Canada is next. Mary Ann, go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Oh, thank you. So my question is, what would you say to someone who says, sure, there is a God, you know, thousands of years ago, but there's no evidence of him today?
Okay, let me ask a clarifying question, because I could understand a claim like that in at least two senses. One of them is there was a God, literally a God, in the past, but he doesn't exist anymore. Or I could understand it to mean God manifested himself in the past, but he doesn't manifest himself anymore. And I guess a third one is, well, there may have been some evidence of God in the past, but he didn't really exist, and there's no evidence of him today. Do you have a sense of which of those three alternatives or something else this person would mean?
Yeah, I would say the third one.
Okay. Well, I would say, no, there is evidence of God today. One of the philosophers have worked out numerous arguments for the existence of God, and they're just as valid today as they were in the past. My favorite is the argument from contingency, which begins by asking the question, why is anything the way it is? You know, and for any given thing you could name, like why is an apple red? Assuming it's a red apple, well, you could propose, okay, well, it's red because it's got these pigments in its skin. That's okay, why does it have these pigments rather than something else? And you could say, well, because these pigments are programmed into its genetic code. Okay, so why does it have this genetic code rather than some other genetic code? Well, because of the process of evolution, it happened to evolve this way. Okay, so why does the process of evolution happen? And you can keep asking the why question, and either you've got an unlimited, infinite mountain of whys, or you've got some ultimate answer that explains all of the others. But an unlimited, limitless sequence of whys does not explain anything. It's like trying to paint a picture. It's like saying, you know, we've got an explanation for this local thing, like the apple being red, and let's transition the image a moment to a red apple in a painting. Why is there a red apple in this painting? Well, because there was paint that was applied to the pigment. And well, why? How did the paint get applied to the pigment? Oh, it was on brushes or bristles. Why were the bristles applying it? Well, because they were attached to a handle. And ultimately, there's an artist moving the handle. And that's why there's a red apple in this painting. We can do the same thing with a red apple in the real world. And you could say, okay, we're going to trace this series of causes back to its root source. There's going to be some ultimate source. And whatever that source is, that's what God is. He's the ultimate cause of everything else. And not just a red apple in the world, but all the apples and everything else in the world. To say there is no ultimate cause would be like saying you can have a red apple in a painting with no artist and an infinitely long brush. Well, an infinitely long brush is analogous to an infinitely long regress of causes. And if there's no fundamental cause moving all of the rest, then it ultimately doesn't explain anything. There's no ultimate explanation. And so in order to have an ultimate explanation, whether it's for a red apple or the entire universe, you need a God. And that's just one example of an argument for God's existence. There are many others. So those are philosophical arguments for God's existence. There are others. And some of those are experiential. Now, your friend mentioned, you know, there was evidence for God in the past. She might have been thinking of miracles, you know, that people would interpret. They'd have some extraordinary experience and say, oh, God must have done this. But the thing is, there are miracles today. There are lots of them. They just don't get reported very often. The Catholic Church actually has a process for rigorously investigating miracles and seeing whether they can be explained naturally or not. It even has atheist doctors looking into medical miracles and saying, is there any explanation for this? They don't care if you're Catholic or not. They just want your medical expertise. And if you'd like to do some reading about modern miracles, there's a two-volume book on miracles by the evangelical scholar Craig Keener, K-E-E-N-E-R. And he's done a lot of work documenting contemporary miracles in the world today. And so not only are there philosophical arguments for God, there are practical, experiential arguments for God as well.
Marianne, I'm going to leave it there and try to get our friend James in the Philippines on because he has been waiting. And James, welcome. Good, happy Saturday morning. Good Saturday morning to you.
Hey, Sa. Hi, Jamie.
Hi, James.
Howdy. We're right, real close to the end of the show. What's your question, James?
Yeah, my question would be, can consecration be done outside of Mass? Should consecration be done separately? Can consecration be done separately? So just to the bread and wine?
Okay.
Or
okay.
Both must be done together?
Okay, thanks, James.
The answer to both questions, according to the Code of Canon Law, is no. And the Code of Canon Law uses the strongest possible term in Latin for this, nefas, which means it may never be done. Never under any circumstances. So you can never consecrate the two elements outside of a Mass. It doesn't have to be a Mass in a church. It could be a Mass in the open country, but it's got to be a Mass. And secondly, you can never, nephos, consecrate one element without the other. You have to consecrate both the bread and the wine in a Mass. Anything else is absolutely forbidden.
Okay, James?
Gotcha. Thanks, guys.
Thanks for calling. I've been saying hello to you every now and then on a Friday afternoon because I know you listen on Saturday mornings.
Thanks, Sai. And salam, Jimmy.
I'm looking forward to the day I get over there to the Philippines and say hello to you in person. But that day has not come.
You'll want to say kumusta.
Oh, kumusta. That's in Tagalog?
Yeah, a Filipino. Tagalog is the base of Filipino. And it comes from Spanish, como está.
Oh, I think you told me that before. Yeah, because we talked about vamanos and or vamos and became vamos in
vamos.
Yeah, to the cowboys out west. Jimmy, thank you very much. I know we'll be seeing you in person shortly, so look forward to seeing you next week for the Catholic Answers Conference.
Indeed, me too.
Well, that does it for us. I'll tell you again, there's a big sale over at shop.catholic.com on all digital media, and it goes on till midnight. Sunday, Honolulu time. So that gives you the whole weekend to get your digital stuff over at shop.catholic.com. We'll see you next time. God willing, right here on Catholic Answers Live.